It's New Letters on the Air. Today we'll hear from the only person to win the prestigious National Book Critics Circle Award for Poetry twice, Albert Goldbarth.
Around my house we call me a two-timer.
Stay with us and you'll get some insight into the mind of the poet who was once described by Poetry Magazine as a maximalist, Albert Goldbarth, on this edition of New Letters on the Air. I'm Angela Elam. Goldbarth is the author of more than 20 collections of poetry and several books of essays. If you're not familiar with his work, it covers a wide range of private and public matters, but in a voice that is unmistakably, well, Albert Goldbarth. I had the opportunity to talk with him in 2002 at KMUW in Wichita, Kansas. He had won not only his second National Book Critics Circle Award for Poetry for his collection Saving Lives, but had also just discovered that he was awarded the Penn Center USA West Award for Creative Nonfiction for his book Many Circles, New and Selected Essays. All of your books, I think, have that sort of quirkiness that is so particular to you, where you just kind of mesh ancient history and pop culture and personal history and the profane and the holy. I mean, it's such a mishmash of things, but, you know, somehow you make it circle around and come back and really speak to the reader, I think, anyway. Or it speaks to me, I should say. Is there anybody that has influenced you to write like this? I can't think of anyone who writes like you.
It seems to me that I see more and more people, particularly lately, attempting to reach out and mix things together in interesting ways. That happens, I guess, when people stay within the world of academia and think they're getting smart. But I really don't think of my own work in terms of direct influence. I mean, Lord knows there are writers I enjoy reading who probably have influenced me in ways I'm not consciously aware of. But I don't have one or two particular role models in mind. I think you're just describing the way that, for better or worse, my brain is neurologically hardwired to work, and that's that.
Yeah. Constantly within your work, it seems that the past is coming up. We're frequently visiting people who have been long since dead, and their spirits come back, and it's in this world, but it's not. You know, that's a lot of what I get, too. In fact, maybe I'll get you to start by reading Canyon Gorge Arroyo.
Okay. Not that I want to assume I'm reading to people who don't know the language just as well as I do, but I'll point out that the very first line has the word codices, C-O-D-I-C-E-S, plural of codex, a kind of early version of a book. And ziggurat, those pyramids from Babylonia, Mesopotamia, that are the truncated-looking versions of more pointy Egyptian pyramids. And this is in five sections, and it begins with a little epigraph, which, if you were looking over my shoulder, you'd see was italicized there at the top of the page. I'll pause briefly between the sections, and I'm reading a poem I barely remember. Canyon Gorge Arroyo. And the epigraph is, the 17th century bibliophile George Thomason, whose specialty was seditious tracts, once buried his collection of over 22,000 publications, fearing their discovery by the army. What if he'd died before he was able to retrieve them? And then the poem proper begins. How many other codices and folios are stored down there, are held in geologic strata, pages that, in trading earth for air, no longer turn. They're like the minute lines that mark a clock. Time moves, but they stay unmoved. My grandpa Louie isn't only in the earth. By now he is the earth, is atomically one with it. And so is all of the old world sensibility that made him so mysterious to me. The way he took tea through a cube of sugar gripped in his yellowing front teeth, and the Russian tavern songs he'd hum along to the hand-cranked music box. The Yiddish language newspaper that he read, however, is still being published. Barely. I imagine its latest sad gray passenger pigeon of an issue pacing circles on his grave, impatient, waiting to fold its paper wings and join him in the darkness, maybe cover his chest, as when, in life, he'd fall asleep under its pages. Canyon, gorge, arroyo, we can see at any cleft in the earth its text on text the whole way down. It's shelving. And someone else may tell us that this is an archaeologist tenderly brushing the dust from a buried line of inscription, or a paleontologist tending to a row of fossil pocks. But we can recognize a librarian when we see one. We think of death as nothing, as a stillness and a void, but it's an active, endless hunger. Of the countless thousands of third millennium Hittite hieroglyphic documents, quote, none has survived for our finding. Done as they were in ink on linen-backed tablets of wood. In time's salivas, a thing like that dissolves like a peppermint lozenge. Occasionally, a relic does float into the present moment. We have ancient Incan quipus, stout main cords and slenderer ancillary threads on which a code of knots served adequately as a kind of writing, cousin to the rosary and the fringe of the Jewish talis. One, recovered from a chieftain's tomb, is 10 pounds of transmitted fact. 10 pounds of knots, as if to remind us what it means for a nervous system to carry our complicated lives. And did you dream? I dreamt. I dreamt I visited Grandpa Louie's grave. You visited Grandpa Louie's grave. Did you enter it? I entered it. I was there in the must. I wandered the city architected of bone and the ghosts of electrical pulses. And what did you see? His life, his Jew ghetto immigrant life that had always seemed more distant to me than the toppled columns of ancient Rome and the Babylonian ziggurats. And did you understand what you saw? I understood what I saw. At last, I felt at home in the gutturals of his Yiddish speech, among the cracked leather straps of his phylacteries, and the watch fob, and the feathered splay of chicken pluck in the wooden bowl. You say at last you understood. I spread apart the shut halves of his ribcage, and I studied. I could read him like an open book.
You just heard Canyon Gorge Arroyo, read by Albert Goldbarth, and it comes from his book Saving Lives, Poems, and it was the winner of the National Book Critics Circle Award for poetry. And this is New Letters on the Air. I should say, with the structure of this book, we start out with this wonderful poem that I'd love to have you read, Library. Mm-hmm. That's a very long piece. It's just such a wonderful look at books and the power of books. And then to come to this one where, you know, you're reading your Grandpa Louie like an open book, it just kind of resonated with me there. And books and the word are a big part of your life. What do you read for fun?
Didn't you use the term mishmash earlier?
Yeah.
I suppose that's true. I guess I do read around widely. Maybe the downside of that is I don't read in depth in any one place, but it's true. I read the supermarket tabloids every week. I love them, and you know, I'm happy enough to pick up a scholarly text in certain subjects too. I have no shame in still reading comic books and picking up an issue of a girly magazine, and you know, I happily read through an annotated edition of the Bible if I'm in search of something specific. I don't think of my work as particularly bookish or erudite. I think there are places in which my work tries to accommodate what some people would call the real world that isn't based upon or doesn't care about the realm of text much at all. But at the same time, it probably is only fair to say that a lot of my work, as does the poem I just read, takes some of its life from seeing all of existence in terms of language that can be read, as codes waiting to be broken, as series of semiotics that we can or cannot understand.
I got a wonderful quote out of one of your poems from Adventures in Ancient Egypt. The words are everything, Mother. The words we save are the words we save everything else in. Sometimes I get the sense that when I'm reading your poems that you as a poet and therefore me as the reader, if I'm going along with it, are unlocking sort of secrets of words. There's a secret in almost every poem of a word. I think it's fun the way your mind works, and I thought I would have you read Power of Weirdness because it kind of gives you a sense of how you use pop culture. The world of the odd or the weird. Do you mind reading that one? It's a little shorter, so.
Is it?
Yeah, it's only 2 pages.
But look at how long these lines are. Look at how uninviting this page is visually. Gee, this must explain my sales figures. This begins with some awfully long sentences. I hope I can read them and make them clear. I should point out that for everything you think is odd, somewhere there's a context in which it's normal. Power of Weirdness. It was clear that night in 1887 in the barn. And so when Mrs. Elmira Masterson found this giant yellow dog in the corner devouring a calf, she dissuaded it mightily with her broom and shooed it into the crisp November darkness, certain of exactly what she did and what she did it to, and therefore swooned the morning after when apprised of her courageous assault upon Nimrod the lion, escaped from Barnum and Bailey's winter Bridgeport quarters during the vast, disastrous conflagration there. It turns out that, no matter how extreme we find a circumstance, and surely Barnum himself is a sterling example of willed bizarritude, the jerkied Fiji mermaid, and the whitewash-rendered sacred albino pachyderm, and his dozens of other zestily done humbuggeries, we also find that life will later ripple it, fillip it, curly-cue its dingus in ways our own belabored piffles of imagination never could. For instance, when the hoodlum-cronied and moneyed city inspector of sewers is on his way home from one more bribe, and out of the lucid blue a block of frozen pea from Flight 1113 fatally smites his pate, a power of logical weirdness so macroscopic we can't see it, like heaven or gravity or a wisp of the visible universe suddenly lumping into a nodule or willowing into a sinuosity in such a way as to knock some cherished cosmologic gospel on its tuchus. Barnum would have understood. His huge American Museum, 5 imposing floors on prime location Broadway, with its Burmese bull and Mrs. Nellis, the armless wonder, and Chang and Eng, the famous eponymous Siamese twins, and America's first hippopotamus, also, quote, not one but two whales, and, as he put it, quote, educated dogs, industrious fleas, automatons, jugglers, living statuary, and so forth, was a zoological, auditological lily of a lecture hall cum rare show you'd think no man or chance could ever noticeably gild. Yet when it burned, July 13th of 1865, for Barnum was tested repeatedly by fires, it provided unexpected marvelosity beyond anything even Barnum's genius snake oil brain might fancy. Thousands gathered to gasp. The giant lady Anna Swan, at 7 feet 11 inches, needed to be jostled through a smashed-in pane by Derek. Firemen opened the cages of tropical birds.
"Well, kiss me arse,"
one rookie kept chanting in awe, a sort of rough-hewn prayer, as cockatoos and mimicky parrots and macaws and toucans spiraled through the smoke like a confetti fall in reverse. A Royal Bengal tiger leaped from the second story and was axed to death. A living scribble of snakes inscribed its uncontested way up Broadway. One ape sauntered jauntily into the newsroom of the New York Herald. I've thought of this at moments of such smallness and such quiet that they seem to come from other solar systems than the one where Barnum ballyhooed his spectacle. But that's the point, of course. Our lives are always maps unfolding into terra incognita, and a man can watch a woman curled in after-carnal stillness in their bed, can sense the easy waves of trust and of satiety she radiates until the room is comfortably filled with these. And then she sleeps, and then he curls up next to her and sleeps. And still, it's lions and fires they'll open into one day unexplainably. Say it's 6 months later, somewhere along the Madagascar shore, where jungle brambles itself to the very lip of the ocean. Here, a Madagascar native on a spirit wander, halts to rest. For 4 days he's been walking with his staff and knife and totem's bag. He knows a lot, where water can be found beneath plant this or that, how far a game cat's cry is, what a god says in the form of a bird. And so he's very happy when this vivid green and lemon fellow settles in a bow, announcing,
"Kiss me arse,"
in a voice that surely means it's from another world.
Power of Weirdness, from the book Saving Lives, and you're listening to Albert Goldbarth here on New Letters on the Air. When you write, do you just start at the beginning and begin to write, or how do you structure things when you're writing?
Well, in general, I'd say I couldn't be general. I mean, I've written a lot of poems. As you know, if you've read the whole book, there are a few poems in there that are about 6-7 lines. There's a poem in the middle of the book that's 18 pages long. There are some poems that ask to be lyrically lush sometimes, and there are poems that ask to be long narratives or ask to be more philosophically abstract than that. So I don't know that I can generalize about the way a poem comes to me and the way I try to give voice to it. I suppose I'd also say, as a more general response to the question, hoping that I don't sound particularly curmudgeonly or arrogant in the answer, that I'm not sure that that's anybody else's business, really. I mean, they're my poems. I write them initially because I find them privately fulfilling. And, yeah, I don't know that I owe an answer to that question to anybody else any more than someone else needs to present their cute little baby to the world and explain what position they were using when the child was conceived.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I'm not sure that's well, maybe it is a bit curmudgeonly, actually, but because everybody is curious about the creative process and how a person's mind works. But I can also understand you wanting to be private about that.
Well, you know, that may be true, what you just said. But it's also true that one doesn't go to a film and expect Steven Spielberg to have to come around the curtain at the end of the film and talk about what was going through his mind when he was...
No, but if one is lucky, one gets a hold of Steven Spielberg and, you know, it would ask him about that, I think. You know, most of the time people are reading the poems without any... I mean, they are just as they are, poems. I'm sorry I interrupted. But
oh, that's okay.
They are as they are, but if they have a chance to get inside the creator's mind, whether it's a movie maker or a poet or a fiction writer or a chef, I mean, people want to know how these things are created. I think that's natural. I think, you know, we're intrigued with that.
It normally doesn't happen. You know, you go see the Martha Graham dance troupe dance, and it is self-sufficient. It stands independently on its own, and the work itself speaks. And on the whole, I'd rather hope that my work operates that way for the right reader.
Oh, I think it definitely does. But on the other hand, I mean, where would the world of academics be if we didn't have people, you know, kind of looking at these works and dissecting them? And I mean, I sort of wonder, do you even know why your mind works the way it works?
Well, no. Yeah. I also don't ask myself those questions very often. I know by now that there are plenty of other writers around, not just poets, who have ready answers for questions of the kind you just asked. Not that I necessarily always believe those are truthful answers as opposed to answers that play well in public, but plenty of writers do seem to have asked themselves those kinds of questions. However their minds work and whatever their need to self-assess their aesthetics, it's not the way my mind works. Consciously, in any case, I'm not writing out of any kind of credo.
I'm not writing toward any particular political goal. I'm not writing with any kind of self-therapy in mind. I'm writing purely to be involved with the poem that's come to me at the moment. I may be lying to myself in some ways. I'm sure I have my subconscious needs, but I don't bring them to the surface much and make them conscious. I'm perfectly happy to go through my life exactly the way it's been working so far, and I really don't need to lift things up to the light in a little pair of tweezers and put them under the microscope that way. And if I do that to myself, it's within the world of the poem, and it's not treating the poem itself as yet a further object for study.
Mm-hmm. No, that makes sense. You know, within the poem sometimes you'll sort of step out of it as the poet. That's part of what makes your poetry so fun. You're in it, and then you're out of it, and you're in it, but it's all one world.
It's a sort of, I suppose, now you're making me think about my
work sorry
in exactly
about that.
The way I suggested I don't want to. I suppose it's a kind of vaudevillian gesture. I think of it happening, and I've always liked these moments, in a Rocky and Bullwinkle cartoon where they're running after Boris and Natasha, and suddenly Bullwinkle screeches to a stop. You see the little puffs of his hooves trying to break his forward movement behind him, and he says something like, "Wait, Rock, that wasn't in the script."
Exactly.
Yeah, and the real world action breaks for the meta-realization that surrounds it.
I might have you end with this poem. It's astronomy. This is something that's very different.
This one is just two stanzas of five lines each with a little dingbat between them. They're meant to work together but be separate occasions. Astronomy. It dies, and a gazillion years in the future, the sight of its dying reaches Earth. Computed in dinosaur years, that's 3 days from the brain's death to its being recognized as dead in the far frontiers of the tale. Night, a party. Come out here for a minute. Dina told me she'd miscarried, but her body hadn't registered that yet. It kept preparing for a birth, and so we sat on the porch in silence for a while in the light of that star.
Astronomy by Albert Goldbarth from his book Saving Lives, winner of the National Book Critics Circle Award for Poetry in 2002. He's since published another book of poems, Combinations of the Universe, and his first novel, Pieces of Pain. New Letters on the Air is a production of New Letters, the quarterly magazine of fine writing published by the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and our current issue features four poems by Albert Goldbarth. To purchase a copy of today's show, produced with help from Leslie Koffler, Alex Smith, Tina Meggs, Dennis Conroe, and KMUW, call 888-548-2477 or email radio@newletters.org. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.